It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site, the links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. Michelle, can you
hear
me?
Hello. I can hear you, John. Can you hear me? Hello? Hello?
Well, good evening. This is John McMullen. We apparently had some technical difficulties on the computer system coming in, but we will begin the show now. It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen welcoming you to this week's episode of the John Mack Radio Show, an affiliate of Rabbit Talk Radio. Carried live each Sunday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Links to previous episodes and the list of upcoming shows are available at my web home, www.johnmack13.com. That's johnmac13.com. www.johnmack13.com. At the same site, the links to my radio and TV interviews, podcasts, videos, and links to my series of newspaper columns. Upcoming episodes of this show will include authors, poets, editors, judges, technologists, pundits, religious leaders, and other people whom I find interesting, and I hope you will too. On my new 15-minute story and opinion show, John Mack's Radio Rant, I may also be accessed by going to my website, once again, www.johnmack13.com, and I'm clicking the John Mack Radio Rants tab for an index of shows. Unlike this show, the new show at the present has no regular schedule, but is produced as a minimum weekly, and I will send out a blast by email and on Facebook saying when it is. Last week, when I did the show, there was a problem in the new studio, And I wound up, because it was poor sound, deleting the show and doing it again. My guest next week on the show is writer, editor, and venture capitalist Stuart Alsop. I hope you'll join us then. Tonight, as you may notice, if you were tuned in, there was some technical problems here also, and hopefully we've surmounted them. And it was a rocky beginning, but away we go. My guest tonight is poet, essayist, educator, and now novelist, Michelle Somerville. I first met Michelle on Facebook a few years ago and found that we had much in common, our roots, poetry, and other writing. I have read her poetry and Huffington Post columns and find her writing to be insightful and pleasing to the mind. And now you, my audience, after that delay, will get to share the pleasure of her company. So let's get started. Good evening, Michelle, and welcome to the show.
Good evening, John. Thank you for having me. It's quite a thrill so far.
It's a thrill for me to speak to you. Let's start at the beginning. Where did you grow up and go to early school?
I grew up in Washington Heights from ages 0 through 8 and moved to Yonkers. I believe I was in Yonkers when Del Bello was mayor, from age 8 through 16, and then 16 through 18 in Riverdale and 18 through 21 in Purchase, New York.
And then where did you go to high school?
I went to Riverdale Country School in Riverdale.
My children went.
I remember that.
And did you begin to write in school?
Yeah, I did write in school. However, when I was at Riverdale, I was really thinking of myself more as a painter and studied with an amazing painter at Riverdale. I wonder if you ever crossed paths with him. His name was Gaylord Florey. And he was a portrait painter as well as an abstract painter. And so for the last 3 years as a high school student, I was chiefly a painter and interested in the figure primarily. And at the time I was starting to write verse, and the painter, who was my instructor, was reading my verse and being very encouraging. I also studied with another truly fine English teacher there who is somewhat legendary, whose name is Jane Bendis, and she's long passed away. But I did start to write pretty seriously as a kid.
And it was all poetry at that time? What did you do?
It's funny. I was actually writing a novel when I was 16, and I'm still writing the same novel. But chiefly poetry and fiction as well.
After high school, then what?
I went to Purchase College. While a student, I worked a lot, and I did a bit of teaching at Purchase College and really fell in love with teaching and studied literature at Purchase and really began to think of myself as a writer. Spent a lot of time with my Irish grandmother during my years at Purchase because she lived in Midtown, or rather in Yorkville, and so it was easy to get there from Midtown. So I really began to write every day and to send work out now and then at Purchase, and had some excellent, excellent teachers there, and spent a lot of time in Manhattan, really getting to know places that had spoken word performances and really taking advantage of the culture of the city, you know, getting $8 tickets to stand in the back of the Metropolitan Opera and going to jazz clubs and so forth. So it was kind of exciting to still have access to Manhattan while being a student up north.
That's another common link. My grandmother lived in New Yorkville. My father grew up in New Yorkville. Mm-hmm. And, of course, now it's called the Upper East Side, but at that time there were legendary German pubs, the Laurel, Cafe Hindenburg, and all the interesting places. And what did you major in at Purchase?
I majored in literature. One of my most wonderful mentors is still my very dear friend, and he was my first-year Latin teacher, a medievalist, and it was funny, he wasn't my instructor. We met really as friends, and to this day, He's one of my great coaches. He was a full professor at Purchase and has since left teaching Purchase, and we're still very much in touch. But I studied literature. Unfortunately, that's about all I studied up there. Most of my reading outside of literature happens on my own time without the benefit of school, which is something I'd like to, once my children are grown, change. I'd love to go back to school.
That's another common link. I teach at Purchase now. I teach two courses two sessions of the same course every semester other than the summer. Now, you also mention, and you know to me, that you studied with Allen Ginsberg. Where was that?
Oh, I studied with Allen Ginsberg for 2 years at Brooklyn College. Yeah, it's funny. I'm always encountering young writers who are very taken with the mythology around Ginsberg, but for me, he was very much my professor. And I associate him more with forcing people to read Blake and complaining about the contemporary poet's lack of reading rigor than I do with a guy, you know, reading naked in San Francisco. He was a wonderful, wonderful, and very old-fashioned teacher. And in some ways, just sitting in a room with him once a week for 2 years completely made a real poet out of me. He just really had a high standard in some ways of excellence. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful teacher.
Now, when did you go to Brooklyn College? Was that after
86 to 88.
And that was for a master's?
Yeah. And it was a bit of a funny story because I had a little bit of trepidation about getting a Master of Fine Arts in writing because I have to confess I'm a little bit old school that way and feel that the best way to learn how to be a writer is just to write and read all the time. However, I was teaching at Midwood High School across the street from Brooklyn College without a master's degree. And I, as a purely practical gesture, enrolled in the MFA program because I wanted to continue teaching high school and I needed a master's degree. And I figured while getting a master's degree, I would just do my education credits. And I wound up inheriting second semester Allen Ginsberg for 2 years. So it was totally lucky. And the program was really wonderful. I managed to get a graduate fellowship there and I won a semester of tuition there and met my closest poet friends there. It was a really wonderful place, in part because the people who were studying verse there were also working all the time and were there in part because it was a city university. So they weren't rarefied. They were working-class writers, and it was great.
Now, were his courses all poetry courses, or were they literature courses?
He used to teach large seminars, and he would open those up to undergrads and fiction writers and drama writers in the Masters of Fine Arts programs. However, for the MFA, one was required to do a seminar each semester, which would be a workshop, and a tutorial, which was one-on-one. I didn't do one-on-ones with him. I did two seminars with him. He got kind of glommed up schedule-wise, I think, and wound up doing seminars in place of some of the tutorials. But I spent a lot of time in very small classes with him, which was lovely. And he did mostly teach poetry. But he was a university professor, I think, and so he did try to include as many students in the university as could possibly be included in the larger seminars he did. And you know, to those he'd invite some extremely interesting poets. Amiri Baraka gave an amazing talk there one time. Anne Waldman, who's a poet I like a lot, gave a great talk. He had John Wieners, who's one of my favorites, who has died, give a talk. So he brought some of the most amazing people writing into the room to talk about writing and to read their work.
I also note that you won both the Lewis Goodman Award for Women's Centered Writing and the MacArthur Award for Poetry. Could you tell us about those and what was
The MacArthur was a small piece of John Ashbery's big genius grant that he, I believe, donated through the program. So that was a semester of tuition. And the funny part about the Women's Writing Award is that although I consider myself an ardent feminist, I'm often accused of political incorrectness in my writing. So I think there might have been a few women floating around who thought, what, her? You know, she got that prize? But that was just a prize for writing that, you know, considered women as the object of the work, I guess is a way to say it.
Now, while you were at Brooklyn, were you also published outside of academia?
Not too much, and the truth is I'm still a little bit, in my own view, underpublished. But I had published in a few small magazines. I had published some book reviews in the Poetry Project newsletter. I had published book reviews in Variety. I had published in the Columbia University General Studies magazine, Quarto. I had published a couple of things in the Purchase Poetry Review, which when it started was a really good magazine. And, you know, I studied also, I was a secretary for 2 years at Columbia after being graduated from Purchase. And I studied with David Ignato, who is a fantastic poet, and kind of the other side of the coin from Allen Ginsberg. And there I met a few students who published some of my work.
You mentioned that you weren't published in too many journals, but the list I went through had many, Hang Loose Press and a whole bunch. But you also won the award, such as having the ex-United States Poet Laureate Billy Collins select Portrait of a Woman for Her Markham. One of your poems is the winner of the New York William Butler Yeats Society Poetry Contest in 2001. Tell us about that process and the feeling that you got when you were noticed.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's very funny because I love Billy's work, and, you know, I found that he's a very controversial poet when you go out in the poetry, contemporary poetry world. You know, the experimental poets don't always love him, and he's considered, quote, accessible, unquote. And I have a really strong feeling about that whole distinction. I rather feel that distinction is total malarkey, that the fact that something has a wide appeal should not render it lesser. But I had three-year-old toddlers at home. I was writing every day, but, you know, I just felt like no one would ever read anything I write. I will never finish any poem. I had the blessing and the curse of really being engaged with the long poem, which, you know, that also has a lot of bearing on how frequently one is able to place work in publications, because, you know, sending a one-page poem over the transit to the Paris Review is one thing, but trying to send your 14-page poem over the transom is entirely another thing, and it can be very discouraging to write long poems, and yet when I'm reading, my favorite poems in English are all long poems. So I wrote this poem and said, what the hey, and I sent it out, and I got the first prize, and it came at a really important time, and, you know, I think it was also very important to me because I feel very Irish, and I feel that in a sense my academy was very much Yorkville, and, you know, going to the Finnegan's Wake on 73rd Street with my grandmother and really listening to the music and the way she spoke. And I was always very enchanted by, you know, the New York Irish Catholic way of expression, and in some ways felt that there was really lots to be mined there. So that made me very happy. It made me very happy to be this mom with two toddler twins at home. I happened to be having a really rocky time in our family, and to win an award, you know, it was really a mitzvah. It really made me feel like a poet, and it really made me feel like staying in the game. And it, you know, came not too long after the grandma died, and it was great.
Speaking of the Arts Connection, in 2003, you also won honorable mention in a poetry contest in Dublin, Ireland. How did you happen to get involved?
I love that one too, because that the guy who picked that one is a poet I love to read. And, you know, I don't know any of these guys. And one of the great things about occasionally picking up an award for me is that because I have three children and because I still very much work as a tutor and worked as a teacher for so many years, I don't really get to treat poetry as a career. I send things out sporadically, and I'm a little willy-nilly about things. But what was really sweet about this one was that I read Charles Simic all the time, and he was the judge, and it was just a bookstore. It was as if Barnes and Noble were to have a contest, it would be like the one I entered. It had this broad appeal, and it was really a pleasure to just to know that. You know, I have a hunch maybe I would translate better over there than here, but. It was really a pleasure to get that and to have that poem read by people and to have it noticed. And Hanging Loose picked it up right away, and so, you know, it found its way into a magazine. And it's in the book that what'll be my next book. It's in Glamorous Life, which should be out before the end of 2015.
How did you happen to even know about this contest?
I don't even remember. I think it must have been the poetry, you know, the Poets and Writers or so, something like that.
Speaking of the Irish, your middle name, I guess it's your maiden name, Madigan.
It's my mom's maiden name.
And your 2009 book, which I have a copy of and have read, Black Irish, also reflects the roots. Tell us something about your feeling for your roots and how they're evidenced in your writing and life.
Well, I was very close to my grandmother, who, and I know, you know, a lot of people write poems about their grandmothers, and I have to say that's one of the things I really, to write about my grandmother, the first poem in Black Irish is about her. I kind of like the fact that it's kind of a hackneyed assignment. You know, when I used to teach poetry, I taught for 2 years at Purchase, and two times I taught a poetry workshop, and you know, I would tell the kids, write about a charming old relative. And they would say, oh, well, and I'd say, no, you're going to do it because it's hackneyed and you're going to take this old thing and make it new somehow. And I was very interested in that. But she was just a real mentor to me because she was very Catholic and she was somebody who was completely uneducated. She went to second grade. She lived on a farm and she had to stop working when she was seven because she was the eldest of six. And yet when she came to the States, she walked down four flights of stairs, every day to go get her newspaper and to read her newspaper. And so I found there was something really magical in that, you know, and she was very lyrical. And how does a person who doesn't read literature and who really doesn't read well become so lyrical? And I think I picked off a lot of the habits of her way of using language, or the features of her way of using language. And not only did I borrow it, I think that by just really being close to her and really having her be this focal point of my adolescence and my young adulthood, and then as she was very old, really being with her and her dying, I think I really absorbed a lot of her music, where it was, you know, the difference between learning a foreign language and they say, I don't know for sure, but they say when you recognize that you've learned a foreign language, once you no longer have to translate the phrase in your head, once you just say it. I think I crossed some kind of line with my grandmother and by extension with my brothers and cousins and aunts and so forth, where I got some of that music, and it didn't sound to me like any other music. You know, I really started to believe that we have this real gift of gab, lack of a more original way to put it. And so it was in my heart, and it got in my head. And I always was very interested in poetry as music, long before any of this was at the forefront of my thinking. And so having access to that kind of music and recognizing that I was absorbing it was really satisfying my own taste for having poetry in my life that was musical, and, you know, potentially for making poetry that was musical. I don't know whether I answered your question, but
certainly did. And then that's another common root. You mentioned your grandmother born on an island. My four grandparents were born on an island. They didn't know each other when they came here, and just to be able to get on those awful called coffin ships, to have the courage to come across the seas to a new place. I wouldn't be here if it weren't for them, obviously, neither would you. And it's amazing that they had that kind of courage. You mentioned the lyrical and the phraseology. I remember a funny story hearing you say that. I interviewed Mary Higgins Clark years ago. And I read her autobiography later, and she picked up on something that I picked up, that at wakes, they don't mention the guy in the coffin other than to say, doesn't he look like himself? Well, who else would he look like? But they also tell the survivors, I'm sorry for your troubles. And she said that she and her husband always laughed at that phrase. And her husband had a terminal illness, and his mother was very upset. She always wanted us, as we naturally do, to die before our children. And when he died, his mother died at the bedside. So Mary Higgins Clark had a double wake. And some fellow came up to her and said, I'm sorry for your double troubles. And she said she went hysterical laughing to people.
Oh, good.
That she was crazy, you know. Could you care to read a poem for us, since we've been talking about your poetry?
Sure. Should I read a wake poem, a piece of a wake poem?
Whatever you would like.
I will read a little bit of – it's too long to read the whole thing. I'll just read a little. But it's from the first poem in Black Irish. And it's – you know, the entire poem is an apostrophe to Mary, the grandmother. And I felt they didn't throw a good wake for my grandmother, that she didn't really have the funeral she wanted. And because my mother and her sister were bossy about it and wanted to just get it done with. And so I tried to think, well, how could I apologize to Mary for the fact that I didn't really help get her a good wake? So I'll just read a tiny bit of it. Sorry, Mary, you didn't get the funeral you'd wanted. Sorry, Mary, you didn't get the send-off you deserved. Oh, Mary, your funeral should have been great crack. There should have been bagpipes and reels. There should have been an Irish tenor, Mary, to sing Ave Maria, my wild Irish rose. Sorry we couldn't all go down to Finnegan's on the corner of First Avenue, Mary. I'm sorry that skinned Flint greenhorn who owned the joint, the one who saw you come in each Saturday night for 3 decades running, Mary, never once bought you a drink on the house, not even on your 85th birthday. That cheek donkey bastard should have bought you a drink, Mary, because you spent a lot of money in that place and always left 20% or more for the girl. I'm sorry no one got drunk at your wake, Mary, not even those of us who were still allowed. If you died a decade earlier when your number was still RE48010, before your daughters had declared war with one another, a war between the states of stubbornness and pettiness, everyone would have been in his cups. But that was before so many saw the light and converted from Catholicism to AA. Sorry, Mary, no one got drunk at your wake. You wouldn't have approved of that, but men these days are better now. They like to clean up and fly straight, take care of their children, and stick around a while.
That must not have gone over very well with the two daughters that you were talking about.
Yeah, they took it okay.
They
made up.
Oh, okay. The best rendition of an Irish wake I've ever seen, there was a movie years ago, and coincidentally, the family name was McMullen, with Dustin Hoffman, Sean Connery, and Matthew Broderick, three generations of this family. And there was an Irish wake there with nuns at it, people drinking in the back, someone selling clothes off a rack, and police there also. So, in addition to poetry, you're also a prolific essayist with opinion pieces that have appeared in the New York Times. In the last year, you've published and reposted nearly 100 essays on religion, culture, arts, and education in the Huffington Post. Now, let's start with religion. You run a blog called Indie Theology. You describe yourself as a progressive Catholic with a book of essays, Born Again Catholic, due out this year. And in the recent Harvard Divinity School Bulletin article, Armed with Jack, you describe raising your children in the Jewish faith. Would you weave all this together for us?
Sure. It's not as confusing as it sounds. I have a pretty serious Roman Catholic practice. At some point, I really decided I loved being Roman Catholic, and I was not going to allow a guy with a mitre to come between me and God. So it's very important to me. But on the other hand, I suppose even before I married, I've been married 30 years. Even before I married a Jew, I had pretty strong feelings about the beauty of Judaism, and I thought if I married a Jew, I wouldn't want to take a Jew out of the faith. I would raise a Jew. And so, as it turned out, my kid's dad wasn't really very religious. He, and I don't just mean Orthodox. He wasn't. I've always been very interested in religion, both intellectually and in my heart. And he, my husband, didn't really have that. So I wound up having to dive fairly deep into Reform Judaism myself in order to create a religious Jewish identity. And their dad was pretty good at creating the cultural identity. So between us, I think we raised kids who think of themselves as Reformed Jews. But in the process, I really developed a very, very, very strong love for Shabbos and the Torah, and a very deep feeling of being able to pray quite fully in the context of high holy days. And some of that is really part of, is properly part of Christian worship. But the truth is, for me, they're very separate. And my strongest religious feeling is that, you know, God is unknowable. And there's, you know, on the earthly plane, there's only so far that we can really go with our, in order to be correct about what God is and what the proper path is. That the best thing we can do is to take the path that feels the most holy. So, you know, it doesn't really feel like a stretch to, it was interesting today, this morning from 1 to 3, I'm learning how to sing Gregorian chant. And we chanted the Tenebrae service and its lamentations, which it usually falls early in August, and the Jewish feast of Tisha B'Av is actually considered, I believe, I'd have to double-check to be absolutely sure, but I believe it's the most somber Jewish holiday because it's as sad as Yom Kippur, but it's you work on Tisha B'Av. So it's just all sorrow, and it's the destruction of the temple. And the thing you do on Tisha B'Av is you read Lamentations. And on Good Friday, if you sing the Lauds, I believe they are, of Tenebrae, you sing Lamentations. So I was singing the Latin translation of the Book of Lamentations today. And, you know, I was, and it, there's a reference to the Hebrew letters, which are transliterated into Latin. And it was just very beautiful and very holy. And in a sense, I don't like the mixing of the religions. My kids are not part Catholic and part Jewish. They're Jewish. sometimes they're atheists, and I tell them, well, that's not uncommon for kids to be atheists. That's fine. But they're identifying as Jews, I believe, and I'm very happy with it. It makes me feel as if I've really done something very good.
I believe that the Tenebrae was also the name of the service that, used to be during Holy Week leading up to Good Friday, that it was something at night, because I remember going
yeah.
to the...
Yeah, oh yeah, it's real. I've gone to abbreviated ones, but I will go to the five-hour... should come. I'll do the five-hour one this year, but it's traditionally celebrated very, very, very late on Holy Thursday after the Mass, or late on Good Friday after the service. And
I remember it as on Holy Wednesday and on Holy Thursday.
Yes, that too also, yeah.
Now, the...
And it ends in total darkness and with a clap of really loud noise.
Right, the lights go out. And,
yeah.
And if you were young and foolish, you'd tickle the person next to you. In the dark, I remember. Now... Your oldest child is of college age now. Did the Jewish religion travel to college, or
yes, it traveled beautifully, actually. And I have a daughter in college at University of Michigan, and she is a twin, and her brother is attending school in New York and is not in college yet. The girl who went to Michigan was the loudest protester at Shabbos dinner. Why do we have to do this? And it's very funny. She's been observing. She's been lighting her Shabbos candles. She goes to Hillel House sometimes for the good food and sometimes, I believe, a little bit to worship. And she is going to Israel this summer, and as a Jew. So I'm totally very pleased. I think she's very blessed, and... I'm very worried about her, but God's going with her, and I'm so happy about it.
I remember a friend of mine who went to Michigan State was not as that devout a Catholic when he went, and after he left, he wound up giving up any religion. But while he was there, he said it was very important to him to get up at Sunday morning and go to Mass just to show to other people that weren't Catholic, this is what Catholics do, and I thought that was very interesting.
Yes.
Now, you describe yourself as a progressive Catholic. In your context, what does that mean? How does that differ from the traditional Roman Catholics who go to regular Mass and do whatever?
Well, I think the question I usually get is, well, why aren't you just Episcopal? In other words, I really have a problem with the fact that there are no women priests. I don't feel comfortable supporting parishes at the present time while there are no women priests. So my contributions are usually through social justice or work. And, had I married a Catholic man, I don't know that I could have raised daughters in the church. Simply because I just really find it repugnant that there are no women priests. I do support a woman ordained under the, radar. I support a Roman Catholic woman priest. She gets my tithes. But I also go to a traditional Roman Catholic Mass, which I just love, and I go every Sunday and often during the week. And I don't often know how to say why I go. The Eucharist is very powerful for me. The sacraments mean a lot to me. But I think gay and lesbian people should be able to get married. I think priests should be able to get married, and I think women should be priests. And I have read enough theology as an autodidact to know that there's really no theological basis for the positions on birth control and for the positions on male-only priesthood. It's just really not sound. And I have a problem with the fact that this Pope hasn't found a way to be more in support of women's ordination. I understand that he's in a political spot and that the church doesn't change overnight, never has, never will. On the other hand, it always changes. So it's just a question of you know, when will it change in this regard? But I feel fairly strongly that people who are mad about a male-only priesthood or who are angry about the persecution of LGBT Catholics should not just all run away, though. I think that if we all run away, they win. And I've been very active in gay lesbian ministry the whole time. For the past 10 years, I helped start a lesbian and gay ministry in my church. We've helped a lot of other Roman Catholic churches start gay and lesbian ministry. I've had the pleasure of attending several baptisms of the children of same-sex couples. And so I, you know, at the parish level, I see very little discrimination against gay and lesbian Catholics and transgender Catholics, and I only encounter priests who are fully in support of female priests. And so in that regard, I'm progressive.
I used to consider myself a Greeley Catholic. I was fairly close to Andrew Greeley by correspondence. And I thought he was terrific. Now, he might not have gone for my calling myself that. One thing that really got me upset was, and it's from Cardinal Dolan in New York, who I think is a very gregarious, outgoing person, much more than Egan was. But for him to lead the charge against contraception in a church that is so anti-abortion, to me, it makes no sense at all. I see contraception as the biggest thing in the way of abortion, and since supposedly 96% of Catholic women believe in contraception, and every priest that I've talked to has said that that if they get asked at the parish level in a confessional, what should I do, that the stock line is inform yourself of the issues and follow your own conscience. It just seems to me crazy to spend money in opposing this when many Catholic hospitals were already providing this insurance to their workers, and their excuse there was, well, the union made us do it. Well, the government's making you do it. So what? Just get on with your lives. You know, I just think that was awful. You've also taught in elementary, secondary, and higher education, and you have another web page, board, B-O-R-E-D, dash O, dash E-D. You obviously have strong feelings on education.
Oh, yeah.
Is there any way that you can put them into a nutshell for us?
Yeah. You know, I bounced around a lot as a teacher, which I think was really a fairly rare experience, in that I learned how people learn. And I think one of the things we're not hearing enough about in the context of public education and public urban education is how do people learn, and how does what they learn or fail to learn at any given stage affect the entire prognosis? And because I've jumped around, I think I've seen a lot of what goes wrong and what goes right. And, you know, I cut my teeth teaching 12 and 13-year-olds in a Catholic school in the Bronx. And I had a huge class, and I was very young myself. And I taught all the subjects. I taught math, social studies.
What school was
catechism.
That?
It was Our Lady of Angels in the Bronx.
Oh, L.A., okay.
And, you know, it was a terribly hard job, but it was terribly exciting, and I learned how to teach. And I kind of went from elementary to high school to freshman English to a little bit of literature and research writing. And some of the most exciting work I've done is, you know, continuing ed classes where some of my students would be 80 years old or 50-year-old nurses, grandmothers work in the night shift and showing up to, you know, learn how to write to start college. And it really politicized me, and it made me realize that all education is predicated on the education that came before. So, you know, the problem of social promotion and just pushing kids through the system for the convenience of the system has created this huge class of mostly poor students, disproportionately Black and brown students, who really just do not have the skills necessary to function in the workplace or in college. And I think there's a lot of ignorance out there. So, you know, I wish there were more people who had taught on that kind of spectrum, because I think the wisdom is so lacking in the policymakers. You know, that there's such a tendency to look at, okay, what do we have to teach middle schoolers? What do we have to teach fourth graders? What do we have to teach freshmen in college? Well, it has to go right at each step. And then just to be more succinct, I really oppose the Common Core, but not for the usual reasons. I oppose charter schools, but not for the usual reasons. I have very strong opinions about co-locations, where you put the new shiny school into the building full of failing schools, and you say, oh, well, you know, you'll get a paint job and you'll get better plumbing, but you then have this variation on separate but equal in a New York City public school in 2014. I think it's very, very damaging. I'm tutoring now in a Brooklyn after-school center, and what I see is just horrendous. I just see kids really deficient in basic skills, and teachers with doing their utmost to do the right thing and just not being able to, and it's very sad, and it's discouraging. And I'm very happy with de Blasio lately. I think he's doing a great job so far, and I hope he doesn't have his hands too tied to continue to prevail.
Well, I've taught for 12 years at Monroe College in the Bronx, and Monroe has three campuses. They have a traditional campus in New Rochelle, a boarding campus where there are traditional students, and there's also foreign students. Mm-hmm. They have a St. Lucia campus. They're asked to by the government to come in there and to teach. But the school in the Bronx was primarily people that had grown up in neighborhoods or in families that did not value education, and they went off to work. And then they realized this isn't going to work out, and they came back to school. By and large, very bright, 98% minority, 98% full-time job. They were going to school. They had to go to school in the last 2 years. They had to graduate in 2 years. So they were taking 4 to 6 courses a semester and working all day. And they were products of New York City public schools, where they, if they knew enough or cared enough in high school to go to an advisor and say, what do I do, they'd get good information. But if they didn't know, they're on their own. And I know that when I went to high school, they were around every 20 minutes the last 2 years. Where are you going to college? Have you done this? Have you done that? They graduated being, as you said, social promotions, using all the wrong tenses and not being able to write, I don't have no, and, you know, and all of this. I'd walk through the halls, and someone would say, he don't, then I'd say, doesn't, mm-hmm. and they'd say, thank you. Mm-hmm. They really wanted to mm-hmm. do well, and
yeah.
they did not have the background to do. They didn't know, for instance, like I grew up in the age where we diagrammed sentences, and I knew that every sentence had to have a subject and a verb. They had run-on sentences they didn't know, and you'd correct them, and they'd make the changes. But
mm-hmm.
they did not get the proper background to be in college, and they could have gotten that if anyone cared other than pushing them through. And I thought that was disgraceful. Now, at Purchase, since most of the students don't come from the inner city, I don't see the same problems. But many who came from New York City said exactly the same thing, that they really didn't know how to write or they didn't know how to do other things till they got to college. And that puts them so far behind the others that it's disgraceful, I think.
It's disgraceful. And, you know, I think that one of the things that happens is we forget that high school students are very intelligent. they are so easy to teach in a sense, even ones with disabilities, even ones with irregular learning modes. They're so easy to teach, and it's such a missed opportunity for the system to just give young people what they need. And it's so much more expensive to push them through. I ran into some of the same – one of my favorite classes ever was a class I taught at night at Baruch. I taught for 2 years at Baruch College. And the class started at 7 o'clock, I guess, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and it was an intro to essay writing class. It was English 101. And I was having a lot of trouble editing their papers because they were adults with jobs, so they read. You know, they read things, and they were smart, but they had no sense of basic writing. So this was the one time in my whole teaching intro to writing at the college level where I thought they should just get a two-session crash course in English grammar. And I was very timid about going to this class of students. Many of them were older than I was and were working in banks and law firms and financial organizations. I was shy about saying, do you guys mind if we just learn grammar and learn how to diagram sentences and I'll tell you what all the prepositions are, because you have a lot of fragments and you have a lot of subordinate clauses that should be independent clauses. And there was really no other way to really, really make them good writers without cluing them into what grammar is. And I have never seen a class of 30 people so interested in a lesson as that crew at Baruch. They were so happy. And afterwards, there were so many remarks to the effect of, I always wanted to learn grammar, but it seemed like it was something that they covered in fifth grade, and I wasn't paying attention, so I thought I missed the grammar bus. And I think a lot of people miss the grammar bus and maybe catch it at the stop when they take Spanish or when they take French. But everybody should learn grammar, because you can't really edit your own copy without a little grammar. How do you know the difference between a sentence fragment and a fragment if you don't know the equation nature of the sentence? And that's grammar. And it's so true. We could do it, and we just don't do it. And so many of my children's teachers in some of the really good schools in New York didn't know any grammar, and that's another problem.
Yeah, and you can't. They always talk about good writers breaking the rules, but you can't break the rules if you don't know what they are. Mm-hmm. And that's a, you know, and these people, as you mentioned, your students, these people that were so willing to learn. Now, I was teaching technology courses, but I had them writing papers and everything, and they knew in the real world they had to be able to express themselves better. It was very impressive. You mentioned your novel earlier, which I see as the title Sucker Punch.
Yeah.
What made you start it years ago and stop it and go back to it now? And is it the same novel, or because you've grown, do you see it quite differently?
Well, it's a big long book, and one of the best ways I can explain why I would write a novel for 30 years and in the meanwhile finish all sorts of other manuscripts is that my two favorite novels are Ulysses and The Brothers Karamazov. And my kids tease me because I've never finished Brothers Karamazov. I had to read it for a summer class in 1979, and I never finished it. And so through the years, I pick it up and start reading it again, and I fall in love with it. And then I stop reading it and read other books, and then I come back to it, and I have to backtrack, and I fall in love with it again, and I see something different every time I look at it, and I believe that I'm reading, even though it's a translation, I believe I'm reading this piece of fiction as I would read a poem, that it opens up with every new reading. And the novels that I'm writing is a little bit like that, in that I don't really write a lot of fiction. I don't write short stories, although I'm lately very interested in short stories. So I've just been keeping this saga in my head, and it shifts a lot. But one of the things I like, and I'm really trying to finish it, I'm really going to try to finish it long before I'm dead. I'm going to try to finish it in a year or so. But one of the things I do like about it is that a lot of extant pieces of prose that I wrote as a kid are still there, and are fine, don't really need much. So it there is a sort of mosaic feel to it. And it follows a bunch of New Yorkers for a couple of generations. And, you know, one of them's a fighter, and I'm a little bit of, I don't allow myself to be a fight fan anymore, but I seem to have some kind of fetish around boxing, and it's the one sport I've always enjoyed as a spectator, and I've even trained a wee bit myself. And, you know, I really am one of the legion writers who sees boxing as this, you know, image for life, to put it really sillily. You know, I think that it's such a rich world, and so there's a lot of boxing in the novel, and I can't say so much about it except that I work on it continually. I never really drop it, and it's in huge boxes, and I have a lot of notes, and it's been helpful to pull out some of it and look at it and talk to my children about writing. My two daughters are excellent writers. I believe that both of them will at some point really throw down with the profession. You know, both of them already published and you know, written one-act plays, and one of them was very good at engineering and rather at math and science, and went off to Michigan to become a poet. You know, I thought she was going to go to medical school or something. So it's interesting to have something you wrote when you were 16, which for me is 40 years ago, and to have it hold up. There's something powerful in it. And I again, believe that adolescents are truly ingenious in a way. So in a way, that doesn't even surprise me, and I feel lucky that I still have pieces of stuff I wrote from then that might still be put to use.
The two best books I've ever read on boxing were Jose Torres' book, a biography of Muhammad Ali called Sting Like a Bee, and he talks about how that all the fighters at that level are gifted physically, and they're in good shape, and that what differentiates them is the mind, how they approach it and what they do, and that Ali was so intimidating to so many people, like Sonny Liston thought he was crazy, that he would do anything to win.
Mm-hmm, right.
And the other book was Joyce Carol Oates' book on boxing. She's a real boxing fan.
Yeah, that's a great book. It's funny. I got into a Facebook skirmish with a guy. You know, somebody posted something about boxing, and then some people who look at it perhaps like you and as I do as this imperfect sport that had so much beauty in it. And he got on and yelled and said, you know, yelled at, he saw that I was a woman, and he, you know, yelled at me in capital letters, like, oh, well, why don't you try getting punched in the face sometime? And, you know, I fought a little as a kid on the street, but also I learned to box. And I must say, one of the most powerful, humiliating moments of my life was a time when, the one time that I put a mask on and sparred. It was the first and last time I sparred, and got hit right on the bridge of my nose. And I just, there was a humiliation and a power, and dare I even say a beauty to it, the likes of which I've never known since.
That's very interesting.
You're very exposed when you fight one-on-one.
Oh, sure.
And there's really nothing else like it.
You mentioned Ulysses before is one of your two favorite books. I know that Ulysses has won so many awards, and the New York Times called it the most important book in the 20th century. But I know very few people who've actually finished Ulysses. I know many people who have started it, but I know very few who have actually finished it.
Really?
Yeah.
I did study it, so I had to read it, but I've read it a couple of times. And I've thrown I've done a couple of Bloom's Days. That's a good way to make yourself read it.
That's what I was going
to
ask.
If you're assigning it to people, you've kind of got to, like, dive in again.
I've done any Bloom's Days, yeah. Describe Bloom's Days for the audience. They may not be aware of it.
Well, you know, it start. I loved the Bloomsdays. That I have so many good Bloomsdays tales. But it's June 13th is the day that the novel is set, and it's a novel that takes place in real time on June 13th. I don't remember the exact date, 1919 or 1918 or something probably. And it's the main character, Bloom, is strolling through Dublin, and you can take his stroll. You can follow his map through Dublin. And he writes about everything from going to the graveyard to the newspaper to the beach to see the fireworks to home where he finds his wife with, you know, he finds evidence his wife has been with another guy, to the church, to the drugstore to buy soap, and he focuses on the minutiae, and it's very poetic and very experimental. And what people who love that book do is celebrate that day by having readings of the book. And in the olden days, about 50 to 35 years ago, Shakespeare and Company and the bookstore in New York City used to hold a marathon with a few people, and they would read the book for as long as it took, and it would take them, I don't know, 32 hours or so to read the whole book. And my very dear friend Bob the Medievalist was in that original crew, and the thing got so big it wound up being a performance in symphony space, which I've seen a couple of times. And you know, the best time to go is the end when Molly reads her soliloquy, which is mad sexy. And I've seen Anne Mira do it, and she was really amazing. And I went up to Symphony Space for Bloom's Day a few years ago, and I took my priest with me. And he's my priest friend, not my pastor. He's a very open-minded guy, but about halfway through Molly's soliloquy, he stands up and says, "I'm going to go sit behind you," because it was just like super, super, you know, pornographic in a way. I mean, it was brilliant. But the performance at Symphony Space is really exquisite. And what I've done is, in a bookstore, I helped in the community bookstore in Park Slope about 10 years ago. I helped throw a very meager reading where people just read segments from the book. And one year at a bar in downtown Brooklyn, an Irish bar run by an Irish woman, I assigned half the books to people, and they read long excerpts, and it was great. There are a lot of buffs. There are a lot of Ulysses buffs out there. And my dream is to do a traveling Bloomsday where you go to the church, you go to the newspaper office, you go to the whorehouse, you go to the shore, or you go out to Rockaway, or you go to Coney Island, and you watch the fireworks. But it's a wonderful book, and I believe it's designed to be read out loud. And when I was in Ireland almost exactly a year ago, on Easter Sunday, I was walking with my three kids near the Trinity College campus, and we saw a little store, and one of the kids said, "Look, Mom, there's a James Joyce store there. It's all James Joyce books." And we went in there, and all four of us took part in this reading of Finnegan's Wake. And Finnegan's Wake is way more out there than Ulysses. I mean, that's the book that really nobody finishes. And I, even the Joyce lover I am, have only read about 250 pages of Finnegan's Wake. But I had my kids reading it, and they complained, but they did a great job. And there were all these traveling scholars there. There were these two Italian professors visiting Ireland for Easter weekend. Took part, and it was amazing. I mean, and it was held in the store where Leopold Bloom bought the soap for his wife. They kept the store afloat to keep it as a kind of Joyce museum, and we just stumbled on it.
Wow.
It was great.
That's some very interesting.
It was great crack.
You mentioned earlier being a tutor at-risk adolescents. Do you also said you're a community activist in programs for the indigent. What's that all about? Tell us about that.
In the last few months, I've deliberately scaled back on some of that just to finish some work. My children sort of need a little more attention. But I've worked with a group. I work at a I worked for a while in a high school in Park Slope called John Jay Complex, and that's one of the schools where there were three struggling schools in the building, and they co-located a 70%, I would estimate, white school for yuppies kids. And so I was so outraged by it. And the kids in the neighborhood were calling it apartheid high and stuff. It was, you know, very, very dramatic a few years back. And so I started to do a little work in that school through a temple. I sat in an English class and kind of helped the guy out in whatever minor ways I possibly could. I work at, for the past few years, I've been working each week at 826 New York City, which is a nationwide after-school program. And that's really a great program, because what young parents can do is enroll their children for free, and the children bring their homework, and we look at their homework, and we help them get through their homework, and they leave at 5. And when they go home, they can read a book or enjoy time with their parents or even watch their favorite television shows without that awful burden of homework hanging over their head. I happen to believe that the homework thing is, you know, the kids should just do homework in school. And that part of the thing you were complaining about earlier, part of the mismanagement of school K through 12, is that homework is meaningless all too often, and that there should be more ascertaining that the lesson has been mastered before the kid walks out the door. And even if that kid's walking out the school door at 5:30, you know, I was talking to my husband earlier about how I think the Bells of St. Mary model, where, or the CYO model that my mother had, where you got out of the school and then you went to the gym to learn how to play basketball, and then the nun yelled at you to go sit in the corner and finish your homework. I think that's the model that we should be using. I think that school should be till 5 o'clock, and that children should be able to come home and have an actual meal. You know, one of the things I always did with my kids, we had a meal every night. We sat at a table. We said grace. We had to talk about what we did during the day. Somebody had to say something about what was in the papers. And it showed later in my children. They were, you know, very articulate as a consequence of that. And so at this after school, the kids really have an adult to help them look at their homework and see what's being demanded, and somebody helps them if they don't understand how to add fractions, or if they, you know, didn't understand the main idea of the paragraph, or if they have to write a paragraph in response, or if they have to look up something about sharks and turtles on the computer. And I love that place, and so I'm there a lot, and you know, I see students privately. I tutor students in essay writing and so forth once in a while. And in terms of activism, I spent about 10 years working in Helping Hands Food Pantry, which is a food pantry that runs out of St. Augustine Church in Park Slope. And there I worked for a few years as an advocate. I worked with lawyers, doing lawyers advising with respect to obtaining free and low-cost health insurance, a little support with landlord-tenant issues, and calculating eligibility for food stamps. And that was a real eye-opener, because that's where I learned that most of the people who need food stamps have full-time jobs, and that there are a lot of people who have full-time jobs and are homeless. And you know, I think that's something that we can't say loud enough, because there's a lot of misinformation concerning homeless people and employment. The whole, to go get a job. Well, I've seen a lot of people with children, full-time jobs, and no homes, and talked to them and gotten to know them. So I guess that about covers that. You know, I tried to sort of throw myself too into the social justice piece of, you know, Catholicism. I think there's a lot of things that are wrong with Roman Catholicism, but I think we do a pretty nice job at some of the social justice work in New York City, and I'm real proud of that.
one of the problems with go get the job, and I approach that from the technology side, is that technology, for all its benefits, is destroying the middle class job market. We wind up replacing workers, a lot of workers, with technology jobs that create good job for some people, not anywhere as many as we replace. And no one says, what do we do with these people who in many cases are either too old, too uneducated, or in some cases not smart enough to be trained for the new jobs. We can't just let them hang out there. And our dysfunctional political system seems only be able to plan for what's going to happen in the next 3 months rather than in the next.
Oh, that's so well said.
And the coincidentally, here's another common thing. My wife and I also work weekly in the neighborhood food pantry. It's interesting that it's run out of the Episcopal Church, and the biggest contributor, other than the stores that contribute, and a lot of them do, including Walmart, trying to make people happy, is the local Catholic Church, the St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, and the pastor of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton is on the board of the food pantry at the Protestant Church, and the people who come through. Well, number one, I was talking to one of the women who runs it yesterday. To how much it's increased since the recession started, and we have three times the number of families, and we give food to 150 to 220 families per week, and these people are so grateful. There isn't anyone who acts as though, hey, hey, owe me this. You know, they are so grateful for being helped, and they're cheery and they do whatever. And every year for both Easter and for Christmas, there's a whole bunch of people because they get turkeys and they get hams or whatever. But it's just an eye-opener that these aren't people on the dole, as everyone said, who don't want to work. Many of them have jobs. And many of them are single parents, and many of them have they used to have jobs, but they don't anymore due to technology. And it's unfortunate that it's unfortunate that the churches and other outfits have to do this, and that there isn't any public outcry. Just that years ago, I remember when Don Imus raised millions of dollars for a veterans rehabilitation center in Texas. I thought that was wonderful that he did it, but why did he have to? I mean, we send people off to war, and they come back with diseases that winds up having 22 people killing themselves a day, and we just let them go.
Of veterans wind up in incarcerated also.
Yeah, the whole thing is disgraceful, and it's great that the churches and the community organization do something, but there's too many people who aren't even aware of this, I'm afraid.
Well, you're so right about the technology, because I think that that's where we're really, you know, when we stopped going to bank tellers lost their jobs.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know that we think about that enough.
And we check ourselves out in the A&P.
I get furious when I'm asked to do that.
There aren't people there. And it's all of these things are deficiencies that make people happy that they can bank from home, or they can use an ATM in 24 hours, or they don't have to wait in lines. But we have to think of what the toll is. We have to think of the people that used to do this job, and what do they do now, and how can we help them, you know? And we don't. Well, you've got all this going on. You've the novel in progress. You have the book of essays about your life as a born-again Catholic. You have a reprint of The Wise Gal, your book-length poem, which I assume you'll have new notes and the forward. You have the new book of verse, probably a jillion essays, all planned for next few years. You're the mother of three children. Do you plan to clone yourself or to never sleep? Or do...
No, I don't. No. It's I'm old. I've been racking up the syllables for a long time. So, no. I spend a lot of time with the kids, and, you know, they come first, and it all gets done.
You mentioned the children a number of times. Tell us about the article in the Harvard Divinity Bulletin.
I was going to say that that article is about my son Jack, who has Asperger's, which is a form of autism, and he works at the Catholic Worker whenever he has time off from school, and it was very funny because I set it up a couple of years ago. I've for years occasionally dipped in to do a shift at the Worker, and there was one summer where all the kids were idle, and I was getting itchy and said, "All right, we're going down to the Bowery, work at the Worker." And the girls did it, and they were fine, and they had to go back to school or wherever they had to go. And my son with Asperger's really took to it. And, you know, one of the interesting things about him is, or about people with autism, is that there's so many misconceptions about who they are, what they feel, what they can do, what they can't do. I've never really believed this about people with autism, but there's this presumption that somehow they're not fully empathetic. And perhaps they aren't fully empathetic in the way we understand it, but my son is very empathetic, and almost in the extreme, you know, he approached this work as just working with brothers and sisters, not with any kind of sense of him being entitled and I'm going to do this charity work or this mitzvah. I'm going. He was completely unselfconscious in his approach to it, and as a result, in a way, I think his being autistic helped him do this work with true excellence, with just a true level of grace that I think most people his age would be incapable of. So the piece is really about Jack's work at the Catholic Worker and also my attempts to discuss what the Jews call tzedakah with my kids. And the idea of tzedakah was something I was reading about. It really means, and I could be wrong about this, I'm not that well schooled as a Jewish scholar, but tzedakah is giving gifts to the world, but really trying to stand back from it and taking the charity piece out of it a little bit, or the charity attitude piece out of it. And, you know, that's the word we use for giving of ourselves. And, you know, I've always taught the kids, look, my kids work at this thing called the Hope Dinner. They set up the tables once a month for this dinner for people with HIV and AIDS, and they've been doing it all their lives. And they don't really have that sense of, oh, we're going to help the people who need special help. They just say, well, this is our job. We've always had to do it. Our mom makes us do it because we're supposed to work. And they've grown up with a really gentle attitude toward people with HIV and people with AIDS. And they understand that people with HIV are among us all the time and that they're objects of scorn too often and objects of prejudice too often. And they understand a little bit about the history of the church and AIDS. And so tzedakah is the way we discuss giving of ourselves to help the people who live near us and with us and share our world. And so, you know, Jack gives a lot of tzedakah in his life. He's had to get a lot of tzedakah. He's had to get a lot of help just to get by. Jack has had a very difficult journey. You know, he's really had terrible experiences with school and bullying and feeling inadequate. And he's required tzedakah. And the piece is really about how he turned it around. And he grew up and he has a great conscience. And he has a kind of divine countenance, and he really gives up a lot of his time and talent to people who have less than he has. And it's wonderful, and, you know, he's a great inspiration to me. You know, I must say the people I know with autism are a great inspiration to me, and I think that people without autism like me should really strain a little more to understand who they are and how immensely evolved and talented they are in ways that people with neurotypical minds can't really grasp. That's what the piece is about.
The first time I ever saw Dan Berrigan was at the Catholic Worker. And
yeah.
Have you ever read Paul Elie's book? It's a biography of four people that he weaves together. Dorothy Day, Merton, Walker Percy, and Flannery.
Flannery, yeah, no, I have read some of that book, and that's supposed to be a fantastic book. I'm going to run out and read it, actually. I read a wonderful review of that book that not long ago that made me want to read it.
I forget the name of the book, but it's Paul Elie, E-L-I-E, and it's a terrific book.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I also heard him speak at something long after I'd read the book. But it covered a lot of bases in exploring your interesting and amazing productive life. What else might you like our audience to know about Michelle Somerville?
Oh, just follow me on Twitter and see what I'm up to. I have a lot of projects that I like to hear from people. You were mentioning you corresponded with Andrew Greeley. I've had some wonder, you know, you talk about technology, the nice part of technology is I've had some really wonderful correspondences with a lot of people in the church, but in things that grew out of things I wrote. And I love to hear from people, and I love to have an audience, and, you know, I feel honored to be able to put things down in writing.
Well, tell us about some of the many websites you have. I mentioned the Indian.
Yeah, the best thing, if you're interested in my syllabification, is to go, you know, follow me on Twitter. But I've got a blog, an education blog, which is Bordeaux Ed.
That's Bored-Ed.
Yeah, It's Bored-O-Education.
Oh, okay.
.com, I believe. I apologize for not being exact. And I have a poetry website too. That's MichelleMadiganSomerville.com. All run together.
And Michelle has one L, and Somerville has one M.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And what is it that Michelle is so often spelled two ways? Some people have two L's and some have one. How does that happen?
I don't know. I think the proper way is my way. I believe that's how they spell it.
Okay, well. Okay.
But I guess people saw L, the French L, which is she. And so somehow the double L evolved. But I believe its most original spelling is the one L. And my Indie Theology is the blog where I get the most traffic. I get a lot of traffic on that one. And that's, you know, that's people. My mom was a very, she passed a little too young, actually. And she was a very devout, angry Catholic. And I always think she's reading my blog from the clouds, my Indie Theology blog, because that's, you know, that's a blog I started. I felt like I had to write in order to keep going to church. I just felt like that was what I had to do to stay in it, and it kind of turned into a project. So I like when people read Indie Theology.
And that's Indie, I-N-D-I-E.
Yeah,
theology.com.
Yeah.
Okay. And would you like to take us out with another poem?
Gosh, sure. Maybe I'll read a sonnet, 14-liner. Does
okay.
that sound good?
That sounds terrific.
Okay, where is it? I did try to mark it, but of course I lost it. Okay, here we go. It's called Kid Madigan. And it's about when I first, the first and last time I sparred. Kid Madigan, you know how to move your feet. You know how to snap out those punches, Michelle, urged the ex-pug as I wrapped my hands in cloth and tape, and he laced me up, and I dug my fingers into the stinking hide, and he tugged the headgear down, which held in it an old boxing scent I found stunning. Tapping gloves, my partner and I commenced with sparring. I slipped a few jabs, ducked a right, but was somehow frozen in my pose, too slow, dispensing might, until that cross landed on the bridge where my nose would have been, and I thought about all the people I loathe, all the low-life scumbags I'd really like to pound, and I stepped to the left before coming around with a nice hook to the head. How splendid the desire to kill with my hands. And feeling like maybe I could was a thrill.
That's Kid Madigan, huh?
Kid Madigan, yeah.
And keeping it in this in the sports motif, well, number one, first, thank you, Michelle. It's been a real pleasure. And,
thank you so much, John.
And you have to get to an Inwood luncheon, please.
Absolutely. I'm going to surprise you, I think, in May.
Okay. And keeping it on the sports tone, and in the words of Met announcer Howie Rose after the Mets win, put it in a book. Tune in next week for my conversation with Stuart Alsop. And until then, as I used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, steady Silver. Let's get out of here. Thank you.